thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
Just a pleasure to welcome back Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University.
It's great to be back with you.
Start off with your new financial advisor. There's a interesting calculator that you've added to your web pages.
Yeah, we have a software program so I'm a professor of economics at Boston University, as you know. Over the years, actually now it's been 26 years, I've been running a company that I started back in 93, which is called Economic Security Planning, Inc., and we put together economics-based financial planning software. And what economists say people should do when it comes to their finances is like day and night compared to what the financial industry is advising them to do. So economists say, look, we're not going to ask you how much you'd like to spend in retirement, what your target is, because if you're rational, that target, the answer to that question should be, I want to spend $1 trillion a day. And it's obviously not affordable. So what we do is we figure out what you've got to spend, and then we figure out how you should spend it such that you can have a smooth living standard, the same living standard through time. And then we also, the next thing we do is we figure out automatically inside the program how to raise that living standard safely by maximizing over Social Security and retirement account withdrawal dates to lower taxes, and whether or not you should annuitize your, take your money as a stream of payments that continues until you live, get a higher kind of return on that, downsize you if you die, you don't leave anything to anybody. But then the third thing we do, which we just introduced, is we run what are called Monte Carlo simulations, where you tell us, the user tells us the program what portfolios they're holding. They might, for example, be holding 50-50 stocks, bonds, and we'll run 500 trajectories of their living standard based on different draws of returns that they might receive on their stocks and the bonds, taking into account how the stocks and the bond returns move together through time. And then we plug all that, we show the results from that, and we also consider two other portfolios that, and people can modify these, but they're default values. One's a safe portfolio, like 20% stock, 80% bonds, and the other's a risky portfolio, 80-20, 80% stock, 20% bonds. We run 500 trajectories for those as well through the rest of your life. And then we take, for each of these strategies of how to invest, we plug them into what's called a expected lifetime utility function, which is a mathematical expression for your lifetime happiness from what your living standard will turn out to be. And we figure out the lifetime happiness from each living standard. Let's say if you're in the 50-50 portfolio, you've got 500 of these living standard paths. We figure out the utility for each one. We take the average, and that's the average or what we call expected lifetime utility from that investment choice. And then we do it for the other two, and then we compare them. So we summarize in one number your lifetime expected utility, and that comparison depends on how risk-averse. So we ask you a question about how risk-tolerant you are. So you give us the answer. We tell you, in effect, based on this utility framework, this provides some guidance in a single number. You can compare the three numbers, which one is likely to provide you the higher lifetime welfare. So it's really a breakthrough because economics, economists and finance professors have been focused on expected utility maximization since the beginning of portfolio theory began in the 1950s. And we've never been able to do it until now in a realistic manner where you take into account the fact that people live, you know, if they're 30 years old, they could live to 100. So you have to deal with 70 paths of, you know, 70 returns that you could have on your assets every year, and you have to deal with people's cash constraints. So we now have for the first time, so we knew how to compute that, and we were able to compute that for research purposes, but it would take a day to process one case. And we've been able to get it to work within about 40 seconds to process three cases. So this is an enormous breakthrough, really a revolution in financial in portfolio analysis and guidance and education that people should can access for, well, the software is selling for $139 at maxify.com, M-A-X-I-F-I.com. So if you're a financial planner listening in, we have a financial planner version that's $499 a year, and it's the same place, maxify.com. And the tool is the same, except that you can run more clients, because we feel that households who want to do it themselves should have the same tools available to them as a professional. And our software is extremely user-friendly. It's routinely ranked number one in, among all the financial planning tools out there. It was the only last summer, one of the personal finance writers for the New York Times wrote a piece about what to do 5 years before retirement. He said the first thing to do is buy Maxify. It's called Maxify Planner. Go to maxify.com and do X, Y, and Z. And he didn't mention a single other software program. He just said do that. Just buy Maxify and run it. That's the first thing to do when you're 5 years from retirement. But I think people should do it when they're 30 years or 40 years from retirement. Every should use it every year. Some people use it every week to help them figure out how much they should spend this year, but also you can break that down into how much I should spend each month and each week. So it's really a lifetime budgeting tool to keep you on track.
People, I think they expect, don't they, the government to take care of them in retirement. But if you want to live at that, you know, the same standard of living that you've had earlier, I mean, you have to prepare. And this is fantastic software for that. We have and we'll have links up for folks to navigate their browsers. I'd like to move on to the article you penned November of last year, The Big Con, Reassessing the Great Recession and Its Fix. You have, I think, a unique approach to the Great Recession of 2008-2009, concerned, if I understand the article correctly, by the short sellers, the people who benefited most from what happened. Can you give us your look at the Great Recession?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I wouldn't want to say, you know, it's just like bad short sellers. It was the short sellers were taking advantage of a bad structure to our banking system. Our banking system is built to fail. It's built to have multiple, what economists call equilibrium, multiple places the economy can go. So if everybody gets scared based on true news or fake news, and it was basically everything that was said about why we should be having a great recession and what caused the great recession in 2008 is just not true. And that's what the paper, The Big Con, at Kotlikoff.net, anybody can just grab it and read it, Kotlikoff.net, The Big Con, is saying that it's looking at all the facts that have been developed since the great recession and have shown that all the allegations about insider rating and subprimes being dominating the mortgage market, and all of them were crap or liar loans and no-doc loans, and all of them went into foreclosure, and nobody had any, none of the bankers had skin in the game, and all the banks were much more leveraged than in the past, and all the households were much more leveraged, and we were having a housing bubble. None of this stuff is true when you look at the facts. So what is true is what economic models of banking, every single economic model of banking has the possibility of the economy just flipping if everybody gets panicked. And that's what happened. We had a panic driven by rumors that weren't true. You know, if you think about and then you also had certainly some of the rumors were being spread by short sellers, but the press was heavily involved in looking at, you know, they would do stories about this particular liar loans when there's millions of mortgages out there, and if you do a TV show about five cases of fraudulent loans, everybody gets the impression that every single mortgage out there in the country is fraudulent. So the point is that we need to have a financial system that is not built to fail, that is fail proof, and that's what I've been proposing since 2008, which is called mutual fund banking, where all the banks, all the financial intermediaries would be run as just 100% equity finance mutual funds. These would be, I think, you know, most people are familiar actually with mutual funds because most of us have 401ks in our jobs. Obviously, a lot of people don't, but those of us who are self-employed and have IRAs, we're also investing in mutual funds. So in the typical mutual fund, you put the money in and you get a shares of stock back to the mutual fund. And if the mutual fund's investments do poorly, your mutual fund shares do poorly. But you can't go to the mutual fund. You can't run on the mutual fund and say, you owe me X, because the mutual fund doesn't owe you anything. You're a co-owner in this investment, and if it lost money, you lost money. So the mutual fund as a go-between, as a financial part of the financial highway system, cannot go under, cannot fail. That's very different from Lehman Brothers that takes your money on a debt basis. It says, give me your money, and I promise to pay it back the minute you want it or within 3 months, depending on the particular type of deposit. And then it goes gambles with it. And then you come for your money, and there's some rumor that Lehman Brothers is in bad shape. Well, you start running for your money, or actually other banks ran for their money that they had deposited with Lehman Brothers. And they also stopped giving credit to lending money, any more money to Lehman Brothers. They wouldn't roll over loans that they've been making to Lehman Brothers. And hedge funds ran on Lehman Brothers, and also Bear Stearns and these other. We had serial collapse of 17 large financial institutions in the U.S., including the biggest, world's biggest insurance company, AIG. So our system is built to have, and Lehman Brothers was from what the SEC says about it, and also Bear Stearns, that both of these companies actually had plenty of what's called bank capital. They had they were running their enterprises in a prudent manner. They would pass today's stress test that the Federal Reserve is now imposing. And indeed, they would have done passed those tests with a higher score than most banks today are passing it, from what I gather. So we have to change our entire mindset about the Great Recession. And I think, you know, we need to understand that the economy can flip, and that every time that we've had a financial crisis in the past, there's been something that sparked it, some bad news, and everybody panicked. If you look at 29, the crash in 29, there was sales of swampland in Florida, and there were some other headline stories about fraud in the financial marketplace. All of a sudden, that was enough to flip everybody's views, and being over the market went down the tubes, and that led everybody to get depressed about the economy. And we've seen this time after time with all the financial crises in the U.S. They're all sparked by something. It's the railroads, some problem with the railroads. Somebody is trying to corner the copper market. Nothing big enough to really matter to the economy, just like Lehman Brothers failing, cannot possibly be big enough to matter to the economy, because the building didn't collapse. None of the employees that worked for Lehman that were fired when they failed were killed. So physically speaking, nothing happened. Everybody just decided Lehman failed, therefore the economy is going to go into a depression. Different people are using that word, the D word, depression. And then you had employers saying, hey, I better fire my employees before the other employers fire theirs, and those other employers' employees are my customers. So I'm firing somebody else's customers, they're firing my customers, and we have complete meltdown. And we started to see layoffs in the hundreds of thousands within a few weeks of Lehman collapsing with no real economic basis. So we need to go to this mutual fund banking system that is absolutely secure. Not a single equity finance mutual fund failed during the Great Recession. The only ones that failed were the market funds, which were leveraged. And they had. So if we get rid of all the leverage in the mutual fund system, just and have no banks that are leveraged, have no debt obligations. We will never have a financial crisis again.
Do you think, though, that that's practical? I mean, don't you think it would be awfully difficult to convince these folks that the way you've been boosting your bottom line and bonuses, leverage, which just, you know, amplifies their returns, how can we convince them that it's no longer in society's benefit?
You know, let's say Elizabeth Warren proposes this. She's very much concerned about the banking system. This would be a great thing for her to champion. And so it's a matter of the government saying, or the Federal Reserve, well, they can pass regulations that tell the Federal Reserve, we want you to gradually put a tax on leverage. If a bank wants to operate with leverage, they have to pay a tax because they're putting everybody at risk. And through time, that tax rate gets bigger and bigger. And we're, at the same time, we're going to be telling all the financial institutions, you're the long run here over the next 10 years is everybody's going to end up selling every single financial instrument, whether it's insurance, whether it's life insurance or car, everything will be done through mutual funds that are 100% equity financed. And it will happen. And, you know, we have we have something like 10,000 equity financed mutual funds in the country right now. We have 9,000 banks. So if you ask, do we have more mutual funds of the kind that I'm talking about than we have banks? The answer is yes. Do we have more people banking through mutual funds than through regular banks, or banking more money through mutual funds than through banks? The answer is yes, because most of us, if we're in the middle class or upper middle class, we have retirement accounts and they're in mutual funds or equity financed, and we have more money in there than we have in our checking account, which is what we're doing with the banks, basically. So we are, our system is about 30% there already. And, you know, if you had a, let's say a hurricane come by and you had some houses built out of straw and some other houses built out of brick, and the houses built out of brick did not collapse, and the houses built out of straw collapsed, and you're the government and you're trying to rebuild the houses, would you go and rebuild the houses out of straw? No, you'd rebuild them out of brick. Well, Dodd-Frank rebuilt our banking system out of straw. We had, and it's no wonder that Barney Frank is now working for the banks. The guys who are in Congress, who are in charge of banking regulations and rules on both the Senate and the House side, are all being paid off by the large banks, the biggest contributors. You can go online and see this yourself, to J.P. Morgan, the biggest contributors to the members of the House Financial Services Committee are companies like J.P. Morgan. So we need to have a leading politician say what Roosevelt said, which is time to stop letting banks gamble with other people's money, which is the taxpayers' money. We got stuck with this huge bill, but even beyond paying off the banks, you know, we had to bail out the banks. Apart from the cost of that, well, there were, you know, 10% unemployment. There were millions of people that became unemployed as a result of this crash. Lots of people lost their life savings. This was a terrible economic tragedy that didn't have to happen. So, and if you think about whether or not, you know, just in terms of each person's personal investment, I know that GoldSeek is partly focused on investing in gold and alternative securities. Well, if you know that the financial system can go down, then you'd want to have a hedge here against that happening by holding gold and commodities, that anything that would not be, that people would seek to get into in the context of a financial crisis. And so the point I'm trying to get across is that whether or not we get the reform I'm talking about, the financial system is built to fail. It didn't fail because of any good economic reason. It can go to more than one place. The way to think about a mobile equilibrium here is to think about it being in a crowded theater, and somebody, let's say, misperceives whether or not they somehow believe they're smelling smoke. Maybe they're not trying to cause a panic, but they think they're smelling smoke. And at any moment, somebody could, their sense of smell could lead them to scream fire. And then you can have a panic where people are trying to run out the door, and then some people get trampled and die. That's the kind of situation we have here. We have two equilibrium. Nobody's screams smoke, and nobody runs. And somebody smells screams smoke, and everybody runs. And it can just happen randomly, just like that. And that's just exactly what happened back in 2008. And if we had had a president, you know, had I been, let's say, president and been able to get on the explain this to the public, it might have helped. If I had been president, I would have gone out to Lehman Brothers and taken a sledgehammer to the building and said, look, here's the only damage to the building. And I would have grabbed one of the employees walking out the door, and I would have done a blood test and said, you know, pricked their finger and said, look, this person seems to be alive. What are you guys so concerned about? That could have changed the psychology. Instead, we had the president screaming, collapsed in panic. He became President Bush, the junior, became immobilized. The Treasury Secretary panicked. The Federal Reserve Chairman, they both panicked. Treasury Secretary is begging on his knees, literally on his knees, Nancy Pelosi for $700 billion to bail out Wall Street. He was panicked, and he spread that panic throughout the country. So he made things worse by his actions, by being panicked. So as opposed to saying, there's nothing real here, and if you want to lose money, sell all your securities to the U.S. government. We'll buy it we'll make a huge profit, and be our guest. Step right up. I'm going to have the Federal Reserve buy all your stocks that you're trying to sell, and the stock market would have risen, not collapsed 500 points a day for the next week after week until they pass this TARP bill. Anyway, I could go on, but you can see where I'm coming from.
Exactly, and you talk a lot about equilibrium. You've also noted in the past that the national debt is way out of equilibrium, as high as $200 trillion when we start to talk about some of these unfunded liabilities and some of the social programs that will require incredible amount of funding. Do you still hold to this thesis, and what are the implications, do you think? Are we looking at declining standard of living as a result of this?
Well, what we're engaged in here is an economic war with our children on multiple fronts. We have, destroying the planet through emissions of carbon, through climate change. We're in the U.S., we have a country that's entirely bankrupt. It's fiscally broke beyond belief because something like 90% of the liabilities of the debts have been put off the books. So Social Security's trustees report, just as an example, came out about 2 weeks ago, and they reported a $43 trillion unfunded liability. It's hidden in the back of the report in Table 6F1. None of the so-called trustees, including our brilliant Treasury Secretary, who had to sign the trustees report, none of them mentioned that we have a $43 trillion fiscal gap in that system, unfunded liability, in their summary, and make no mention of it. And it actually went up $10 trillion between last year and this year because of changes in interest rates that they're using to calculate it. So we ran a $10 trillion deficit in Social Security between 2018 and 2019, and not a single member of the press, nobody in Congress. The only person who wrote about it was yours truly, who wrote a piece for The Hill. And, I don't know how many people read it, but if you go to Kotlikoff.net, you can see a link to it, and maybe you can read it and spread it around. But the system we have a whole path of outlays as projected by the Congressional Budget Office, which in present value the value in the present exceed the path of receipts of taxes and other receipts to the tune of $239 trillion right now. That's $239 trillion. The GDP of the country is about $21 trillion. So we're talking about more than 10 years of GDP, about 11 years of GDP. The official debt's about $21 trillion. So we've got 90% of our fiscal problem here is off the books. And this is net of, it's not just a gross liability, it's net of the taxes to pay off these outlay obligations, expenditure obligations, no matter what you call them, including servicing the official debt. We have to come up with money. And at some point, it becomes game over for our kids, because you can only take all their wages away from them to pay for Social Security benefits for the old people, for Medicare benefits, for Medicaid benefits, 70% of which go to old people, for the tax cuts you're giving old people, for the Social Security benefits. You can only take 100% of their wages, and we're heading in that direction to, you know, this is Argentina, which declined. It took a century for Argentina to decline to the point of going from being a fifth highest per capita GDP country in the world, one of the richest, to one of the poorest, not one of the poorest, but a developing country again. It was a developed country, now it's turned itself into a developing country through reckless, irresponsible fiscal policy, and that's exactly what we're running, and it's getting worse every year. And Trump's cutting taxes, even though I like certain aspects of the Tax Reform Act, I think structurally it was better than nothing. In some ways it's good for the economy, but what we needed at the same time as making certain structural fixes was to get the total tax take to be higher. Now we're running a $1 trillion deficit that's I think what's projected for next year. But again, that's small. If Social Security's deficit went up $9 trillion, $9 trillion between last year and this year, then we're missing the forest for the trees.
Exactly. You mentioned Argentina, and their neighbor, Venezuela, is experiencing hyperinflation and obviously currency issues there. Do you see anything like that on our horizon?
Yeah, the first thing that people in government will do is to put pressure on the Federal Reserve to print money, because as it looks more likely that the country starts running larger and larger deficits, the interest rates will go up, the Federal Reserve will print money to try and lower them. At some point, people will be smart enough to realize that that's going to lead to inflation, and interest rates will go up even higher. And then the Fed may say, well, it's not my fault, it's not our fault, we're just trying to keep the interest rates low, they'll print even more money. And they'll just put some compliant head of the Federal Reserve in office, and just like we had a pretty good inflation in the 70s that Arthur Burns cooked up at the behest of Richard Nixon, we'll have some president like Trump who puts in some crony. And he tried to put Steve Moore on the board. You cannot come up with a more unqualified person, even though Steve is somebody I consider, he's an acquaintance, and I like talking to him, and we've been friendly with each other for years and had some good conversations. He's nobody's lunch meat. He knows some things, but he's not sufficiently mature, I think, in that role. But Trump wanted to put him in, and some future Trump will put in some future crony to start printing money, because he doesn't want to go to the public and say, we need to raise taxes or cut spending. And just in the case of Social Security, we need 4 cents on the dollar higher taxes. That's basically a one-third increase in the FICA tax. Everybody on this call is listening to this your radio show, not this call, but is listening to my call with you, is probably, most people are probably working, and they can all look at their pay stub and see how much is coming out of FICA. Think about that for Social Security and Medicare taxes. Think about the Social Security part of that going up by a third. That's what the Social Security actuaries told us we needed to do. 2 weeks ago, they told us this in this Table 6F1 to get rid of this, to pay off this unfunded $43 trillion fiscal gap in Social Security. If we don't raise taxes by a third, FICA taxes for Social Security by a third starting immediately, we're going to have to put a raise it by a bigger percentage in 10 years or 20 years, an even bigger one. And that means that our kids are going to pay an even higher tax rate. And we, current older generations who are still working, are going to get off the hook. Because 20 years from now, yours truly, for example, won't be paying any FICA taxes. But my kids may end up paying not a 12.3% Social Security FICA tax, but a 25% FICA tax. There are countries around the world, like Russia, has a 32% FICA tax in effect. They don't call it a FICA tax, but and then when the taxes get that high, people stop working. Formally, they go into the underground economy or they leave the country, and then the tax base shrinks, and everything just kind of boils down. You know, melts down from there. So that's why you end up in a country like, in a situation like Argentina. So the but the tendency of the government to print money in these kinds of situations is well proven, and it will happen here as well. And that means inflation will take off, and that means alternative investments like gold will do better in those contexts. So I think everybody should be prudent about their investments and be diversified to hold things that are hedges against financial panics and fiscal, our fiscal indebtedness, our fiscal insolvency. That's what we're facing here. And we don't know exactly when Wall Street is going to wake up. The public will really understand the degree to which we are broke. I think I'm the only person in the country who's tracking these numbers and talking publicly on the radio and what I write to convey the degree of to which our country is broke. We have some other economists who are writing that we should actually expand the debt. We should borrow even more. The deficit's not big enough. And, you know, there's always good things to do with more money, right? There's lots of, the country's got all kinds of problems, education systems needs help, infrastructure. We have a lot of poor people. They certainly could use help. We got a lot of poor older people. They could use higher Social Security benefits. But we have basically been engaged in a Ponzi scheme to pay, to get where we are now, to get to dig this hole. So if we keep borrowing to give money to current people, we're going to leave an even bigger bill for future people. So we'll have even poor people in the future. So we have to think about this through time, not just as a what's going to get me elected this time around.
No, I think you make a great point. I mean, this has been a luxury we've had as the holder, you might say, or printer, the global reserve currency. I mean, the world needs our dollars for the current, you know, dollar petrol arrangement, but that's changing. As I know you've noted in the past, I mean, there are alternatives now for some of our major trading partners as far as currencies go, and ways to procure oil and other strategic resources that doesn't require the reserve currency. So we're, over time, as we heap, as you say, debt on top of debt, essentially devalue our own currency, we're sowing the seeds of our own economic destruction. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, people can move out of the dollar. Right now they can move into Bitcoin if they wanted. They can... there's other currencies they can use to transact with. In Europe, a lot of people have dollar accounts as well as euro accounts. So if everybody decides that everybody else is moving into, let's say, bitcoins and away from the dollars because they're worried that the Fed is going to be printing too much money, that will lead to an even bigger money. Dollars becomes more of a hot potato, and faster money is like more money and leads to more inflation. So we already are seeing signs of people preparing themselves to get out of dollars because they're worried about the future of the dollar. And the other key thing here is that the U.S. economy now is about 17% of the world economy. After World War II, we were about 50% of the world economy. Where are we going to be at the end of the century? We're going to be about 5% of world output because there's an enormous population boom going on as projected by the UN. We're going to go from about 7.6 billion people to about 11.2 billion by the end of the century over the next 80 years. That's just an incredible number of extra people. And as they become more productive, as they catch up productivity-wise, as you see happening in China to the U.S., we're just going to become a smaller and smaller player in the world stage. So the dollar is not necessarily going to be the dominant currency even 20 years from now, let alone 80 years from now, when China, it could be that sub-Saharan Africa is the biggest world economy because they're going to have so many people, and if their productivity catches up, even not even fully, but let's say 50% catches up relative to the U.S., they're going to be producing far more output than the U.S. So the really big players in the future could be the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, and India. It's hard to believe that, but if you look at the interaction of the demographics and the potential for productivity catch-up, then China would be like the fourth largest economy. They're actually losing population. They're losing about a U.S. worth of population in terms of losing about 400 million people by the end of the century because of their historic one China policy and one child policy. The U.S. is actually expanding its population by one Japan. We're increasing by an extra 120 million people by the end of the century. This is why things are getting so congested here and why I think a lot of people are perhaps nervous about immigration because of the they're seeing a lot more congestion when they're driving around. That's one way to just see, you know, extra people means unless we really prepare for where people are going to live, and they all may move into the cities, and we may have gridlock in every city in the country. So what I'm just saying is that there are big factors going on. The U.S. is not going to be the big player on the block down the road. It's just the demographics are destiny to a large extent. And the demographics are saying that, even though we're keeping up population-wise kind of proportionally, the other countries are going to catch up with us in terms of productivity, but they're also going to be their populations. We're talking about certain regions of the world are just going to be, exploding in size. And other regions like Europe, they're going to basically maintain their population. Japan's going to decline by about 40 million people. Russia's population will drop by about 20 million. So, and China will drop by about 400 million. So the future is going to be a very different world, and the U.S. is not going to be dominating it.
So a lot to think about today, a lot of food for thought. I mean, look, we've got to try to encourage our officials to curtail, and that's putting it, I think, nicely, this enormous debt. I mean, according to your records, $239 trillion, 11 times our annual output here as a nation, our GDP, just an enormous sum that can never be repaid with our current obligations or we lose our benefits. So all the more reason to keep up with your idea, your Maxify and other resources to prepare for retirement, because it looks like our government will be insolvent. If we stay on this path, these are just a few of the key takeaways you've given us to think about today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, anytime.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange, and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. OneGold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. OneGold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through OneGold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, OneGold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.